I'm not going mad.
Welcome to Gatekeeper, a podcast about booking from the bookers and gatekeepers who decide who's in, who's out. Also, there's other stuff.
And now, your host of Gatekeeper, artistic director of the Hollywood Improv, Jamie Flam.
Hello and welcome to Gatekeeper. It's a podcast about booking and all that kind of shit. And there's cussing. So if you like cussing, you're in for some treats. No holds barred when it comes to language. Although there are a few words that we try to stay away from. And I'm way off track. I'm just going to dive right in. I'm excited about this guest. We're not doing a full intro this week. There's not like a whole long intro where I'm doing jokes and trying to tell stories and such. Just me and my guest right here. I'm not looking him in the eye because I'm rambling and a little bit self-conscious. I also have a different producer. Andrew's not here. We have Sean running the show. Sean, how are you? Great. Sean, one thing that I need to do... In lieu of doing this intro, to keep the thematic with how the show goes, we'll need to drop a sound effect right here. So in post-production, they're going to put some sort of sound effect there to because that's an important part of the show. It's not important, but it's important to me because it's enchanting and magical, and that's the kind of experience I want to create. Speaking of enchanting and magical, Josh Sandoval, who's looking right at me, don't say anything yet, your intro... You are a comedy producer. You are a comedy booker. You are a comedy writer. You do a little bit of everything. You're a modern day Renaissance man.
See, I like that intro. You say that wasn't an intro, but that's a pretty good intro.
I went for it. I mean, I think it's this coffee talking.
Yeah, no, I mean, is that coffee? I thought it was soda, but...
Oh, I mean, it could be a Diet Coke or it could be an iced tea.
Nice.
It's homemade, I'll tell you that much. Yes, I got these plastic cups at home. I bought plastic cups.
And then brought him to the improv.
Yeah.
Okay.
Josh Sandoval, how you doing, buddy?
Good, man. I'm still recovering from Montreal, but I do like that intro because it's so funny because I make fun of people who say they're like a director / producer / writer / waiter or whatever you want to call them, and I call them slashers, but I am all those things. It's weird. I don't know how to describe myself, but you did a good job.
I've known you for a while, and it's been cool to watch your career evolve in the last few years. So you were in Montreal. I was in Montreal with you.
You were.
Let's give a quick overview of what that was like, and then we'll get to the beginning of your career.
Yeah, it feels weird, or I mean, it feels right to be sitting at a table like this, a square table with you, but usually it was for the past week at 1 a.m. till about 3 a.m., scattered with scattered paperwork and about 4 other people sitting with us discussing performances we saw of the press.
So we were hired as TV set vetters for the JFL Montreal Just for Last Festival. Explain what that job is.
Geez, well, I was brought on in June, and as soon as they got bookings as soon as they started confirming people for Montreal, I started getting comedian assignments. So originally there was 3 of us and some guy from the UK named Ben and Colleen, who is all over the United States, and me. And we started getting comedian assignments and networks that they were going to be taping TV sets for. And so usually on TV shows like, you know, Tonight Show with Jimmy Fallon, Colbert, all these late night shows, they have a comedy booker who goes over the sets that are going to be taped for the show. So we, which eventually you came on, and we got these comedian assignments who were going to be taping TV sets for 6 different networks. And we had to go over all the standards and practices with them. We had to make sure that their content was going to be evergreen so that the set could air, you know, 11 months down the road, and just make sure that it would be passable content for television.
Explain what kind of TV content is produced at JFL.
Well, they have 6 different networks this year, which I guess normally they have 5 or so, but the networks were HBO Canada and CISO all in the same one. Obviously, HBO Canada is in Canada and CISO is, you know, in the States. And then there was a Showtime special, a CW special, the Comedy Network, and who am I forgetting?
LOL.
LOL, yeah, Kevin Hart's network.
And so every year, How many comics recorded TV sets this year?
Jeez, I think it was probably around 300, wouldn't you say?
So that's crazy. So 300 comics went to Montreal, yeah, and over the course of a week shot sets that would be airing on all these various networks.
And multiple comic, or many comics were taping multiple sets, which is, you know, hard to keep track of too. I mean, everybody who was taping multiple sets worked with the same set vetter, but oftentimes I didn't even see some of the people that I was working with because there was so many comics, so many shows. We were all scattered throughout the festival. Like, somebody I was really looking forward to seeing how his set played out was Louis Anderson, because I had spent weeks, you know, months talking with him about his set. And it just so happened that I couldn't see his warm-up set or his taping because my schedule in Montreal didn't coincide with him. But you saw him, mm-hmm, his warm-up set, and he was great.
Right.
So we all kept in constant communication throughout the festival to make sure that our people who had problems in their sets, or even if they didn't have problems in their sets, we still maintained communication to ensure that they had the best taping possible.
Yeah, that's a good way of distilling it down.
Yeah.
So it's crazy. And so every set that people did, they were, for the most part, given a warm-up set.
Right.
And there are these scattered venues across Montreal. And it's really surreal. I mean, Louis Anderson, watching him, he's a guy that did a gala. So right, like, how many people are in an audience for like a gala?
Oh, God, there was several thousand.
So
I mean,
these huge, epic, big shows with multiple camera shoots. And then seeing Louis in Theater St. Catherine, which right, is like a, you know, 90-seat little theater.
Right. It reminds me of the Lab a little bit here, mm-hmm, at the Improv, where it's real intimate and you're right up on the crowd. And you have this legend like Louis playing this place that normally, you know, sees nothing against it, but it's very like musical comedy and kind of sketch shows and stuff like that. And you have this guy like Louis, and I think Louis Black played there. George Wallace played there. It's these small little clubs that are hosting these legends who are warming up their TV sets, which is insane.
I mean, it's surreal to me. I mean, seeing Todd Barry and Janine Garofalo was there one night and like giving them notes on their set.
Yeah.
How did you feel? I mean, for me, sometimes like talking to these luminaries, I'm like, you don't want my notes. Like, well, who am I?
It's so funny because I think I talked to you about this before we went up there that, you know, I was giving notes to Louis Anderson the whole time for months talking about his set. And I did the math and I'm like, he's been doing stand-up comedy longer than I've been alive, because I'm 30 years old and he's been doing it well longer than that. And you feel kind of silly sometimes talking to these legends like that. But then when you catch something that makes their set even better, you're like, oh yeah, I am good at this, or I am supposed to be doing this, or there is a reason why my position exists. You know, one of the highlights for me was working with Greg Proops. I mean, you know, Greg, he's such a great dude. One of the things that, you know, not just him, but many people at the festival, you know, you want to talk about in your set stuff that's going on right now. And, you know, normally when you're warming up a TV set, you're thinking about how, just to make it as funny as possible. Generally, if you're going to be doing like the Tonight Show or something like that, you're going to tape your set. It's going to air that night or within the week at least. And this is a little bit of a different thing where you're taping a TV set. It might air 11 months down the road. So everybody was wanting to do stuff that was material about current events like Donald Trump. I mean, I don't know how many sets that you got that had mention of Donald Trump. Like, if he wins the election, we're blah, 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 blah.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, 11 months down the road when the set's going to air, it's going to look silly on television. So that was one of the things that I had to work on a lot with comedians.
Yeah, and it's hard right now with everything going on for them not to talk about that.
Right. And so, I mean, oftentimes you could find somebody who had that in their set and then just change their, you know, the intro to the bit. Like, I remember working with Ronnie Chiang from The Daily Show. Like, he is brilliant. That was the first time I'd ever seen him perform live. And he had I had heard so many Donald Trump jokes by the end of the festival, but one of the second to last day, I think it was, that I was there, he did a Trump joke that the intro just didn't work for his TV set, but it was such a good joke that we sat there trying to make it work, the intro. So we reworked the intro and he crushed his set. I mean, it was such a brilliant Trump joke comparing Donald Trump to Eminem and 8 Mile. And I mean, I don't want to go into the bit because I can't do it justice, but when you see things like that, you really want to work especially hard to make that joke work for television.
Mm-hmm. That's awesome. Were there any standouts or other people that you had never seen before that?
Yeah, I think I mentioned this with you a few times, but Russell Kane from England, I'd never heard of the guy. I asked Ben, our UK colleague, and, you know, he talked about how Russell is, you know, he's on television out there and stuff, but I mean, he's not like a huge name by any means. And he crushed the festival. Like I told him afterwards, I was like, if you come to the States, I will help you out in any way I can. Cause it was just amazing. Like, I mean, there's a lot of amazing British comics, like, you know, Jimmy Carr, Alan Carr, those guys are great and terrific. I've seen those guys before. I've never seen Russell Kane before. He blew me away. And then also seeing how people kind of evolve and change a little bit. Like Jessica Curson was amazing.
I just put her name down because she was such a standout.
Yeah. And it's like, I've seen her for years, but I don't know what it was that was different about her. And I've always loved her, but it was like a whole nother level this time seeing her. Maybe it was because I got to see her night in, night out, that type of thing. But she was amazing. What about you? Did you see anybody that stood out to you?
A lot of people. I mean, it's funny. I book a comedy club for a living, but you know, there is a lot of the same people.
Mm-hmm.
I think being in Montreal, and part of it, it's how worldly it is.
Right.
Like you mentioned, Russell Kane, but there was so many great Australian comics that I'd never seen before.
Yeah.
Dive Hughes.
Yeah. Dive.
And a whole list yesterday for Levity, the company I work for, mm-hmm. they want everyone to do, basically go like send in a list of coverage of all the comics we saw. And so I just made this list and I was like, God, I think like a quarter of these, if not more, are Australian comics. And just seeing the professionals, that was your first time in Montreal, right?
It was my first time in Montreal. I mean, I've gone to other festivals, but there's nothing like Montreal.
And it is the industry festival. And I might've talked about this on the postcard that you listened to earlier, but it really puts in perspective that comedy is a business.
Yeah.
I mean, not that it has to be a business, but that, you know, if you want to make a career in it, like there is this world and this industry around it. And it was interesting to me to see a lot of comics and sometimes younger comics, when you see them outside of just a club in LA and in the context of this festival,
right,
where the industry is around them, and you see how you know, some for professional and some less professional,
yeah,
and how they deal with, all right, you have two TV sets, what are you working on? The ones that were like, here, you know, they sent their transcript in 3 weeks early versus the ones like, it's like, all right, they're going on in 2 hours and we have no idea what they're doing.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely have some stories of people that I won't name names of, but I mean, I was blown away at some of the people who I thought were more professional than they were. I mean, I can't imagine, I never imagined that there would be people who would be taping a TV set that's going to air to millions of people, and they show up to Montreal with no idea what they're going to do. And I mean, it's this, I don't want this to sound wrong, but I mean, I am going to be seeing you and booking and producing other TV shows in the future. Like, why would you make this so difficult working with me when you know that people are going to ask me my opinion on what the experience was like working with mm-hmm. you? I mean, there was one comic who cursed me out in the middle of the festival, like in the middle of the street. I mean, I was looking around like, is this really happening right now? And simply put, I'm trying to help everybody have the best experience possible. And I mean, I get with comedy, and you probably experience this as well, that comedy is very much a personal thing for a lot of comedians and a lot of writers. And it's just a very thing that's close to their heart. So I get that. But when you have those experiences in a place where, like, you know that this is such an industry heavy thing. I mean, there was a few people who I'm like still in shock by that it happened, like the negative experience, but that's obviously very, very small percentage. I mean, for the majority, it was great experience working with everybody.
And you said 300 comics, and I think, you know, 95% were easy to, and then in some of them that they're such artists and so brilliant. And, you know, you worry about them until the minute they get on stage, you're like, all right, they got it. They just, you kind of, you know, they're going to do what they're going to do, but they're also cool.
Right.
And, you know, I feel like my reputation is usually that I'm pretty even tempered and even keeled and, you know, just be cool. Everything's fine. I feel like you're like a step beyond that. So to even think about someone.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think we try to be conduits to, you know, especially the industry can be so brutal.
Right.
And there are so many assholes and comics dealing with crazy agents and managers and TV producers. Like, for us to be, hey, we're just here to help, you know, remembering that not all people in the industry
Yeah.
Are looking just to, you know, suck you dry for all your talent. No, no, we just want to help you.
Yeah. My whole career has been built on trying to make other people look better, whether it was producing TV hosts and or producing talent for TV shows. Like, if they look good, I look good. Mm-hmm. And I try to always express that to people. And for the most part, people get it. But you're always going to get a few people who just want to battle you on everything, and they don't even know why they're battling you.
Right. I one more standout that I'll mention is Matt Donaher.
Yes.
Who's this great comic. He's really smart, good one-liners, and just brilliant writer,
mm-hmm.
who did Conan earlier this year and then was a new face.
Yeah.
And I think every year it seems like there's one or two maybe new faces. It's their first time. This is their big first time on the big stage in front of the industry, who got scooped up to be on a gala.
Yeah, a big one too. The CW gala that was hosted by Howie Mandel.
So that was, as a vetter for me, like my one moment to shine, because, you know, you were dealing with the Lewis Blacks, and most of my clients
right.
were the younger comics that were doing TV for the first time, and they're doing LOL, which you can basically do anything.
Right.
But for Matt to get on this, and then it was so squeaky clean.
Yeah.
So even his, you know, he's a pretty clean comic.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, but any... we can cut out that weird, like, or maybe not. I don't know. It was an authentic moment. But then to have no sexual references whatsoever, none of that. So to see him and actually get to work with him and, you know, tell him you can't do this, or maybe you can, you know.
Right.
And how cool and appreciative he was, and his agent and manager. And like, it's.
Oh, yeah.
You know, to see young people and when they're cool as fuck.
Well,
you know, their career's going to be good.
Speaking about him, I was impressed because I was at the rehearsal for that gala that he was on. So I'm seeing him walk out there right after Jay Farrell walked out there, right after Joe Coy walked out there, right after, I'm trying to think who else was on that gala. But I mean, it was a mega gala. There was no like non-headliner on that gala. And during rehearsal, seeing him walk out there and own the stage and act like he belonged there is a huge deal. Like seeing this guy who, yeah, he did Conan, but Conan is a singular performance. Like you're the only stand-up comedian on that show. But seeing him go up there, tape something that was with all these people who are mega stars was pretty cool to see. And I know you had been working with him. So that was, I was thinking about you actually when I saw him walk on stage.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun. And I mean, if you haven't been to Montreal, I highly recommend it, especially if you're a young comic. I know it's a lot of money, but if you can save up, if you're a young comic, seeing stand-up in this world, you know, I wish when I was doing stand-up I'd had seen it, because it really is such an education. You know, this is, you know, of course there are ways around it. There are ways you can build your career that doesn't require that you go through this route. You know, there's tons of great comics that were not a new face. But
right.
If you want to see how this industry works and maximize your opportunity to have a successful career as a stand-up, you'll just see how it operates.
And even if you're not a comic, even if you're in some capacity of the comedy world like myself, I mean, it was an eye-opener for me as somebody who, you know, spends almost every night in comedy clubs. It's good to get in a different arena where you're around it. You're just around different stuff. Like you had mentioned, I had never seen so many international comedians at once. And to see how solid they are. And I mean, obviously it sounds kind of, I don't know, arrogant as an American to say that, you know, comedians in America are better or anything like that. But I mean, there was some British acts and some Australian acts that were just like, wow, I need to go to other parts of the world to see them.
Italian
as well. Oh boy, that guy was fun.
We won't name any names. There was an Italian comic that apparently you said he did some research, and he's
huge in Italy. Like he apparently can't walk down the streets in Italy, and I mean he I don't know how to describe it, but it was like,
did he give the microphone a blowjob?
No, he didn't.
Oh, okay,
I'm disappointed. You told me about that, but. It was, I don't know. The thing that I took most from Montreal, I think, was like the working on the other end of things, like working on the, because each night we would sit down and we would talk about who did well that night and then pace the lineups, like who would go first, second, third, fourth, and close and all that kind of stuff. I mean, that's something you do a lot, I'm sure, at the improv.
I would say that was, to me, the most rewarding part. So at the end of every night, you know, we were all given our assignments. We were out at these clubs watching comics, taking copious notes. And then there were four or five of us would sit around this table. And so we're like, all right, CW Gala's tomorrow. Let's go through and like, Josh, who do you see tonight? And be like, all right, Greg Proops, he's on top of his game. He, you know, he killed it tonight. We can put him anywhere in the lineup.
Right.
And then there's the ones, all right, this person was struggling. I think it was just the crowd.
Yeah.
But just the science behind it. And obviously I do that every single night at Hollywood Improv is
right.
pace these lineups. But the stakes are lower. Obviously you want there to be a flow to the show
mm-hmm.
and, you know, balance all these egos. But for a huge TV taping, it's, you know, you get one shot. And so you need to make sure that if someone's struggling or their set's not good, that, you know, I've never thought of that idea of protecting.
Like, right. Yeah, that was interesting too, because also, I mean, there was other factors other than just like comedians. I mean, there was sketches in between. Sometimes there was act breaks. Sometimes
right.
there was intermissions. Like there was, you know, stuff that could potentially slow down, you know, the laughter in the room. And there were so many factors to consider. I mean, there would be some nights where we would just be looking at that and go, well, what do we do with this? Like, and eventually, I don't think there was any like huge mishaps because we really, we took 2 hours each night to look at these shows. And usually it was about like six shows a night that we were looking at. But for me, that's something that I've never really done on a TV show because TV shows, I mean, like America's Got Talent was a big one where I would do stuff and I would just be working on, you know, comics when other people would be working on singers and stuff like that. So it was a good experience for me to learn that. And I guess for you on another level.
Yeah. With the stakes so much higher.
Yeah.
And I don't think most people think about that. And including, you know, even show producers that I know in LA that,
right.
you know, they're just like, all right, we got six great comics. Have fun, guys.
Yeah.
And just, but like there really should be a rhyme or reason to energy levels and, you know, not wanting to have three, you know, low energy, you know, one-liner comics in a row. And so that was really cool. I mean, and I talked about this a lot, like in LA, on the one hand, we're spoiled
mm-hmm.
and every night is its own festival.
Right.
But also it's not a live theater town.
Yeah.
And, you know, granted, you know, on any given night, any of the clubs and any of these small shows can be packed. And granted in Montreal, it's a week and it's everything packed in, but to be going from venue to venue, venues that are, you know, 50, capacity to, you know, 5,000, and
right.
they're all packed and everyone's killing. Everyone's great. And I was thinking the whole time, like, I wish LA had that culture.
Yeah.
Because we have all the talent.
Yeah. It's interesting. I think it's so successful in Montreal just because people put their, for the most part, people put their egos aside. And in LA, they don't. Just because it's the day-to-day thing. And I don't think you could go to like any club here in LA and see, I mean, there was galas where like Brian Posehn opened a gala.
Mm-hmm.
That dude closes shows. You know what I mean? Like there was shows where I'm trying to think of other examples, but you know, you had guys like Louis Anderson going up like second mm-hmm. or Louis Black. Didn't Louis Black open a show?
I think he opened it. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, you know, these people put their egos aside and just did it. You know, it's for some reason, I just think it's something in LA that you just, I don't know how to explain it, but it's, I mean, it's the ego capital of the world. You're not going to get yep. people to put it aside.
Well, there's Montreal for you. The one last one, I'd never seen JB's move.
Oh yeah. Live.
Live.
Yeah.
And to see him, you know, destroy. And of course he, you know, did 20 minutes, what was supposed to be
yeah.
an 8-minute set
yeah.
In front of like 90 people at Comedy Works one night was just another level of performance and showmanship that was just like, that's fucking amazing.
It's so funny that you say that because he did 20 minutes at Theater St. Catherine, also doing a warm-up set. And that dude put so much energy into a set. And I was blown away. Like seeing him just crush in front of, I think there might have been 50 people in the audience mm-hmm. and he was performing like it was 50,000
mm-hmm.
and that was really cool to seeing guys not phone it in.
Yep.
You know, that they very easily could have. I mean, he wasn't getting paid for that individual performance. I mean, this dude makes money on the weekends doing a show, and he acted like it was like he was getting paid 50,000.
Yeah.
You know,
God bless him.
Yeah.
An artist, true artist.
Exactly.
And I guess another funny thing worth mentioning is, like, you know, we'd have our meeting would start at 1 a.m.
Yeah.
And we were in a small room next to the bar in the Hyatt where, I mean, that's the other epic part of Montreal is the bar, the Hyatt bar most nights is, that's the epicenter of schmoozing, I would say.
Right.
And, you know, that bar is packed and one night Comedy Central is buying the bar and one night Funny or Die or whatever it
Netflix,
is.
Netflix, yeah.
So it's everyone in the industry and every artist and just getting trashed. And we're in the small room next door working.
Well, I think the funniest thing to me was I would go to Roast Battle each night and go to the viewing party that was upstairs where there was an open bar in between. Like, I would get out of the last show that I was at like 11:45 or midnight and then have an hour to do nothing. So I would go and hang out with all my friends up at the viewing party and have a couple drinks and then go to the meeting, mm-hmm. which is hilarious because in what other profession can you do that? You know, which I got to commend you on. You only had one crazy night.
That was maybe my greatest accomplishment as a human was to go to Montreal for a week. And yeah, Friday night got a little loose. There was a dance party. But other than that, yeah, I didn't drink. Just for me, I mean, we don't have to get into
No, but I'm exhausted still. We're recording this 3 days after I got back from Montreal and I'm sore. Like, I'm tired. And it's not just because of like partying and stuff like that, but all the work. I mean, I commend you. You were very smart about what you did up there. Because not me.
No, I mean, it was still a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Anyway, let's go on to other stuff that we can talk about.
Yeah.
I mean, you're 30 years old, still a baby, a young sapling in the forest that is comedy careers.
I like that.
What, how long have you been booking? Like, just what's the quick, origin story?
I mean, I grew up in comedy clubs because my uncle was a stand-up comedian. I grew up with just a single mom. So he kind of took me under his wing down in San Diego when Bud opened the La Jolla Improv. My uncle actually did like the tile for the La Jolla Improv and in order to get stage time from Bud. And every time I see Bud, he always brings that up. But, you know, my uncle was the door guy at the Comedy Store in La Jolla also. And then comedy's always been in my blood. I was 1 week old and I've seen videotape of my uncle doing bits about me on stage. So it was like, there was no choice that I was going to end up in this profession. I said no to this profession at first. I was a journalist with like outlets like the LA Times and San Diego Union Tribune. But when I came up here from San Diego at 21, my uncle was working on a TV show. They needed somebody to be a voiceover director. And I was doing the LA Times that day and that show at night. The director of that show got fired after a week. So I became the director at 21 years old.
That's like a straight out of a inspirational story.
Yeah. So at that point, it was with all comedians. And I had, you know, grown up in the comedy club scene. Guys like my uncle was opening for guys like Gabriel Iglesias, Paul Rodriguez, George Lopez, guys like that. So I was always around big time comics. But once I moved up here, I started regularly coming up to the Improv and, you know, the Comedy Store, but mainly the Improv, and hanging out and just started getting immersed in this scene even more so. I was starting to be recognized as somebody who knew comedy beyond just being involved with my uncle. So I started booking shows like, I don't know, a year later on this show called Latino 101 for Nuvo TV, which was CTV at the time, I think. Mm-hmm. And I gave a lot of people a lot of people who are doing very well now, some of their first TV credits, like Melissa Villaseñor, Jade Catapretta, Michelle Buteau, Gina Brion, just a lot of Latino.
Ladies.
Yeah, a lot of, actually, that's true. A lot of
that's
ladies.
Awesome.
And then I brought in a lot of famous Latinos as well and some non-famous Latinos. Some famous non-Latinos. Like, I worked with Godfrey on that show, Edward James Olmos, Carlos Alazraki, and it was a blast. And so
Edward James Olmos, one of the stand-up legends.
Yeah, exactly. Actually, the only time he's ever done comedy was on that show.
Stand up and deliver. I'm sure that's been
done many times. Met a world peace, Ron Artest. The first time he ever did comedy was on that show. And then all of a sudden he started playing the Improvs. So
yeah, he headlined a couple of shows here.
Yeah. So I did that, and then I realized how much I liked it. And I was producing shows at the time, too. I produced like a show for ESPN called Around the Horn, and then just got more and more involved in comedy-related things, like always writing. And I found a kind of a combination of the two when I started producing like TV hosts. Like I produced Jerry Springer on a show called Baggage on the Road. I worked with Kirk Fox on a talk show called The Test.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, I've always kind of found a way to work comedy into whatever I'm doing. America's Got Talent came out of the blue. That's what kind of changed the game for me, was I had gone through a little bit of a lull for about, I don't know, 9 months. I couldn't get a job on a show. I had gone back to like writing journalistically, and I created a blog. The blog got some attention. Somebody from America's Got Talent saw what I was doing with the blog. I was doing crazy things like jumping out of airplanes, getting tattoos, doing stuff that I'd never done before.
That was what the blog was all about?
Yeah, it's called the Discomfort Blog. I still do it every once in a while, but things have gotten a little crazy for me to not be able to do it as much. Somebody on America's Got Talent saw what I was doing. A former coworker who I'd worked with on Latino 101, she said, why don't you come in and interview for this social media position? I did that, got the job. Comedians started finding out that I was working on that show. They, of course, asked me for advice on how to audition, and I helped them get a bunch of auditions. One of those people was Taylor Williamson, who I had grown up with in San Diego. Taylor ends up crushing his audition. They ask him how he heard about it, about the audition, because it was an open call, and he mentions my name. And they basically switched me from doing social media stuff to booking comedians on the show. I ended up doing that for a couple of years. I was also recommending people to that show for years before because I knew people. Like I recommended Melissa Villaseñor, who did well on the show. But when Taylor got second place on that show, it basically changed everything for me. I made friends with the showrunner on that show, who gave me an open door to go and pitch him any comedy-related projects. And that's kind of when I started getting my foot in the door for pitching shows. So when people ask me what it is that I do now, I say all the things that I do, and it's hard for me to say. I just kind of say I'm a producer, because right now what I've been doing has just been pitching shows and selling shows. And this year's been a good year for that. Got a deal at Telepictures. Last week when we were in Montreal, I got a deal at MTV.
So cool.
But it's all related to comedy. Like the deal at Telepictures was two comedians bringing me an idea, and I formatted it into a TV show idea. Same thing happened with the deal at MTV. Two comedians came to me with a TV show idea, and I formatted it into a TV show idea. So I'm kind of finding what my niche is right now. I think my niche is working with comedians, collaborating with them, and turning their ideas into something that I think networks would want to buy.
What is that process like? What do they bring you, and what are you molding?
So, like, one of the ideas, I'll talk about the one which I have all the paperwork completely signed and done with. The MTV one is still in, you know, negotiations on my contract and stuff. But that one, Jamar Neighbors, had this idea for a game show. And he took it to Josh Nassar, and who they were really good friends with. Jamar presented like 20 pages of paperwork, like just thoughts and ideas for this game show. Josh whittled it down to probably like 10 pages and then came to me and said, I think this is a really good idea. What do you think? Because Josh had known I had done a bunch of game shows. I've done like probably 5 game shows for Game Show Network in the past 2 years. And I took it and then formatted it into a game show that had like 3 different rounds, would be clear and concise, not jumbled all over the place, something that I think addresses something that's pertinent into current day, like current events, that type of thing. And something that I think people would be entertaining and excited to watch. And then looked at who I think might be a buyer for that show, which networks might be interested in it. Because it's kind of a bro-y, college-themed show. You're not going to want to take that to, like, Oxygen Network or something.
Sure.
Which I have contacts at Oxygen Network, but I'm not going to take them that idea because they would just laugh me out the room. So we identified networks that would be good for it, production companies that would be good for it. And every project's kind of different because sometimes you can go straight to a network. Sometimes you should go to a production company first because the idea isn't quite there and they can help you with the development of it. Sometimes you don't have the resources that a production company might have. So with that one, we sold it to a production company. And the one that I just went with MTV at, I went straight to MTV because it didn't need any more development on it. It was ready to go. I knew they would be a buyer for this, and it happened quick. With the other one, it took like 9 months. Like, it was a long time. So, I mean, every process is different, but for the most part, I think comedians haven't made, they haven't done the transition to television by themselves. So I think it's sometimes good to work with somebody who understands comedians like me and understands what networks want like me. And I don't think there's necessarily that many people who do that role, because it's hard to start off with like a general idea and whittle it down into something. But I think that's what my career path is going into now.
Do you have any advice on just pitching in general? Like, when you go in these rooms, what is your technique?
God,
what have you learned? I mean, I'm sure it's pretty broad.
Yeah, it's really, really difficult to address that sometimes. Like, for me, I tend to just have like a really good time. Jamar is one of my favorite people to go into a room with because he just doesn't care. Like, he just treats it like he's meeting a friend, and he's really loose. I like to be really loose. I try not to take it too serious because in the grand scheme of things, we're just making television. You know, it's not like we're doing, you know, everybody always says curing cancer. It's not like we're curing cancer. So we just try to go in, have a good time, and just talk to them like we would be talking to anybody. Like, we try not to be too formal. Like, I remember one time me and Jamar and Josh, we went into, I think it was either MTV or CAA, and Jamar's wearing like a cutoff t-shirt, no sleeves. And we go in there and we just start talking, like shooting the shit, not even anything about the project for the first like 5 minutes. We're just laughing back and forth, joking around. And I think it depends on who it is that you're meeting with. But for the most part, if you go in there just joking, having a good time, and then lead into the business stuff, I think people have a little bit more fun with you, because these people sit and listen to pitches all day long. Like, I kind of took a little bit from the advice that I would give to comedians when they would go in and audition for America's Got Talent. I would always say, you know, you get 90 seconds to perform, but before your 90 seconds start, show off your personality, because they're judging you from the moment you walk in. It's the same thing with pitching people at a network. They're judging you from the moment they meet you. Before you even start talking about the project, they're going to be judging you. They're going to be seeing if they want to, if it's going to be fun to work with you. I mean, I know that's what it's like when I ask people, or when I hire people for a show, which isn't all the time, but I want to be working with people that are fun. I mean, I think that's why we all got into this business. So,
yeah. And that, I mean, it circles back to Montreal and these TV sets and everything. And kind of the theme of the show is just, it always comes down to that. Who do people want to work with? I mean, your talent has to be so ridiculously insane for anyone to tolerate a diva.
Yeah.
And there's a small handful of people that can do that, but also not to advocate forever not being cool.
Right.
But yeah, that's people want to, if they're going to work with you on a show for the next few months or years of their life.
Yeah.
They want it to do with someone that's going to be great.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And I think that's something that is forgotten. People just, you're right. I'm trying to think of, like, there's been some shows where I've been absolutely miserable. And I mean, I've only ever quit one TV show. And it was because I was working 100 hours a week with people that I didn't enjoy being around. And after a month, out of 4 months, I was like, I'm done. I didn't choose this career to be miserable. And I think that can be forgotten a lot of the time. Like, I've been doing this now for a little over 9 years, and I've only quit one TV show, because for the most part, I think people get that.
Yeah. So what is, I mean, do you have a goal in mind that you're working towards, or just see how it organically plays out?
Yeah. I mean, I want to be a showrunner. Like, the head guy, the guy who's the executive producer and makes all the final calls on things and has to be the liaison between the network and the show and that type of thing. It's hard to get in that position. There's very few guys like that. I mean, there's the guys like Chuck Lorre, and, you know, he's the one that everybody always knows. There's people like, you know, Simon Cowell, who are just the executive producer and has their name on it, and they don't run the show. But I like playing the game of chess. Like, I like moving the pieces around. You know, I like the nuts and bolts of things, the day-to-day operations. And it's really hard to get to that position. I mean, most of the time when people get in that position, it's because it's a show they created. And it's usually not your first show. Like, usually you have to create a few shows before you get to that role. Mm-hmm. Some people can work their way up, you know, from PA to associate producer to supervising producer to co-EP to EP to showrunner.
Like, you know, the chain.
Yeah, there's a big chain.
Is Craft Services ever in their chain?
No, but they're my favorite people on set. I enjoy them a little too much. But, I mean, showrunner, like somebody who creates shows and then gets to run their shows and execute their vision, that's what I want to do. And it's, I mean, it's hard. Like, I've gotten quite a few deals and then nothing happens with those deals. But that ultimately, I mean, people have always told me that they think I should be a manager because I know comedians pretty well and how to communicate with them. But I always tell people, I'm like, I have enough trouble managing my own career. Mm-hmm. Like, why do I want to bring on other people? But I don't know. I think it'd be just that. Yeah. I mean, obviously I love writing shows, but in the grand scheme of things, like, you know, I want to reach the highest level of what it is in my industry. And I think that would be cool. I think running a network one day would be awesome. But then again, you know, you're helping other people get their visions done. I'd like to see my vision get accomplished once. So
do you, how much credit do you give just hanging out at a club for, you know, where you're at?
Well, it's so funny because I owe everything to the comedy clubs, especially the improv. Like, I mean, and this is, I'm not just saying this because I'm sitting here with you, but honestly, this place has been, I always say it's like my Cheers, but it's basically like my home. I have gotten everything from this place. Somebody who, you know, first and foremost, I met my girlfriend here. I met her, which was in the bar where the lab is now. I met her there a little over a year and a half ago. I met the booker of The Tonight Show, Michael Cox, I met here, who has recommended me for numerous jobs. And then I've met numerous comedians like, you know, Jamar here at the Improv. Like, this is where I got to know him, where he felt comfortable enough one day to, you know, say, hey, do you want to work on this project with me? Which has got me a deal somewhere. I mean, everything has been from the grassroots of just going out to comedy clubs. And all those three people are people that I met at the Improv. Mm-hmm. I mean, I can go down the list of even more people. I think also comedians respect me because they see me in the comedy club scene, not just in an office.
Right.
I can't stress how important that is, that people, that comedians see you in their place of business, not just in your place of business. I mean, I think it's best to see comedians in the rawest form rather than on a tape, because you can see if that tape was edited, mm-hmm. or you can see how the crowd is reacting. You can just see it in a more natural state. I mean, it's been, I owe everything to the comedy clubs, especially the Improv.
Awesome. Well, Josh, do you have any parting thoughts or ideas or things you want to impart to,
I think,
you know, comics or anyone listening?
I think the number one thing is, like, you got to be constantly changing who you are and hustling and adapting. I mean, I myself, if I didn't create that blog a few years back, I wouldn't have got the job with America's Got Talent. I do a podcast. Like, you do a podcast. I mean, you have to adapt with the times. You got to be constantly doing things. And you can't just sit back and wait for other people to create opportunities for you. I think that's the one thing that I've always stressed, is that I got to be constantly moving. I have never done anything the traditional route. I think anybody who's ever gotten anything in this business has not done it the traditional route. Mm-hmm. And I mean, like, I've never gone through a writer's program. I've never gone through an internship. I've never gone through anything like that. Everything that I've gotten has been simply on my own hustle. I don't have an agent or a manager. I set up my own meetings at MTV and NBC and all these different places. And I mean, I got all those opportunities simply just by going out and meeting people. Don't be afraid. For the most part, people are going to listen to you if you show some sort of initiative.
So keep working. I mean, I think that is so valuable. It is easy to sit back and watch months tick away when you're not doing anything. But that, I think that's really cool that, like, you know, a blog, especially one of taking you out of your comfort zone is what got you back in the game.
That's exactly it. And I mean, I think the one thing that makes you most uncomfortable is the thing that you should try. That would be it.
I love it. Well, thanks for coming on.
No, thanks for having me. It was fun. I'm glad we got to continue Montreal.
Yeah, and you'll come do it again. I think the listeners will love to see. Once you can announce, you know, the MTV thing.
Yeah.
And you know, I want to explore more because that's the path I'm on to making TV shows.
Yeah.
And creating content. So
absolutely, would love to.
You're a blessed soul. As I say at the end of every episode, to the listeners and anyone, work on your craft endlessly, whatever that might be. Be a professional, be undeniable, and be cool as fuck always. This has been Gatekeeper. For more episodes of Gatekeeper, you can subscribe to us on iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can find me online at jamieflam.com and at jamieflam on Twitter. A very special thanks to the Sideshow Network, the Hollywood Improv, Andrew Steven, Sean Merrick, Roddy Swearingen, and producer Buddy Peace for the awesome music at the top and end of this episode. And be sure to check out hollywood.improv.com for updates on great new shows coming up in the main room and the lab.